Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast, the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Thank you for joining us once again here. It's been a while. Welcome back. It's been a while that we ended this show on kind of a fizzle a little bit ago. And I thought that everybody out there, Air Raid listeners abound, deserved a explanation. So, I'm your host, Aaron Roden, and welcome back, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Air Raid. Now, I know I've been gone a while, and that I promised everybody two last episodes of the Air Raid podcast a while back. But due to some medical issues with my family, I was unable to really get those shows going. Plus, we had a couple cancellations of the guests that we had lined up, which I was so excited about. I was so extremely excited about those guests, but everything kind of fell through. And due to the medical issues that we were having in my immediate family, I just did not have the time nor the energy to continue to put these out. Now, this had been coming around the bend for a little while. I was getting pretty tired and holding down a 9-to-5 job, having two small children, medical issues in the family, and then doing this podcast, which I did still love, was just too much. And one thing had to go, and it was the Air Raid podcast. But we do really appreciate everybody sticking with us for those 6 years. It was absolutely awesome. It was such an awesome experience. But we come to you on a good note here. Let's see, this episode, because we are here, or I am here, to announce that we have a new show. The show is called Artist Home. And in this post that we're putting up here, we're going to be featuring episode number 4 of the Artist Home podcast. And I hope you guys really enjoy it. The good people over there, Kevin Sir, Phil O'Sullivan, Chad Cliburn, thought that this was a great idea to start putting out a Artist Home podcast. It's basically just a new spin on Air Raid. And they're giving me a lot of resources and a lot of help. They're handling a lot of the out of the box stuff, for lack of a better term, that goes on with podcasts, like social media and booking and stuff like that. So I'm getting a ton of help now with this new show, and we've got 4 episodes up for you over at artisthome.org, or you can go on SoundCloud. We're also available on iTunes and everywhere else you get your podcasts. But they're giving me time to actually work on this show. And I am now creating the podcast that I always wanted to create. I always wanted Air Raid. Once we started like getting into the thick of what Air Raid actually was, right? Talking with, cultural icons from the Northwest and beyond, this is the show that I always wanted to turn Air Raid into, but never had the time, nor did I have the resources to do so. So now we've got that, and I am making the show that I've always wanted to make. It's in the same vein as Air Raid. I'm really, really pumped about it. I hope you can hear that in my voice, but I'm really pumped about this show. It's in the same vein of a candid interview, but with a little bit extra there. A lot of editing goes into this. A lot of music goes into it, and we're able to kind of feature the music from the artist, or the art from the artist, as we go forward here. So I hope you guys really, really enjoy it. And once again, you can find that this new show at artisthome.org, and everywhere you get your podcasts, iTunes, SoundCloud, everywhere else. New contact info if you guys want to get in touch with me and, you know, say how the show is going. I would love to hear from you again. My new email is aaron@artisthome.org. So you can send me your messages and your signs of relief that the show is now back, right? And if you do go to iTunes, please leave a great review. We could really use your help out on that too, because we are just starting out and we want as many people to hear this as possible. We have 4 shows available. This one that we're going to play, this week or this time around, is going to be with Eric Hawk of the band Portugal the Man. We've also got Dave Depper with Death Gab for Cutie, which I also put up in this Air Raid feed, which you can hear. And also some really great artists, one by the name of Chris Staples, a guy that I had always wanted to talk to, and also Courtney Marie Andrews, a woman whose name you will know soon, especially if you listen to the episode, but she is just exploding over in Europe. Great Americana artist, kind of Americana country style stuff. So I hope you guys really enjoy that. Big thanks to all of you who have tuned in to Air Raid through the years. We really, really appreciate it. I know this probably isn't going to make it out to everyone who used to listen because it has been so long. But those who are tuning in this time around, thank you, thank you, thank you. It has been an honor to have you be listeners of this show. And it was kind of sad to wrap things up, and I'm sorry that I didn't let everybody know what the heck was going on, but it just was too much. It was absolutely too much. I had to drop everything. Everything's good now. I will have you know that everything is awesome. We're doing great as a family. We're healthy, and things are still going. So please tune into Artist Home, the new show. We're going to have one show a month. It's going to come out the first of every month. And, like I said, it's Air Raid adjacent, right? It's a new spin on what I always, always wanted to do. So here, everybody, thank you so much for bearing with me here. Here's episode number 4 of Artist Home, the all-new podcast, with Eric Hawk of the chart-topping, and that's no lie right there, number 1 in the Billboard charts, Portugal the Man. Eric Hawk, guitarist of Portugal the Man, and talking about their hits with Feel It Still and a bunch of other stuff, too. How Eric became a paraplegic. So, interesting and heartfelt story. Okay, here it is. Episode number 4. Love you guys. Thank you so much. And this will be the last time we post anything up on Air Raid. By the way, the archives will always be there at air-raid.net. Thank you. Love you. Have a great day.
The Artist Home podcast may contain adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello.
Hey, Kev, it's Aaron.
What's up, buddy? How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I hear you guys got something going on for New Year's Eve.
Yes, we have our 6th annual New Year's Eve party, which is going to happen at the Neptune Theater, and it's going to be incredible.
That sounds awesome. What's what does this thing entail?
It entails like all your favorite singers and members of your favorite bands rotating on and off the stage throughout the night, performing cover songs that are perfect for New Year's Eve. It is by far the most fun thing that we do. I can't even explain how incredibly awesome this thing is.
I know you always talk about this. You always tell me about it, and I'm actually going to be there this year, so I'm really excited.
Awesome.
Where can people go and find tickets for this thing?
Go to stgpresents.org. Tickets are $45 until the end of October, and then they go up to $50. So get them now and have one less thing to worry about for the holidays.
Awesome.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Kev. We're going to get started with the show.
All right, man. Have a fun one.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to Artist Home, the show where every month we get an intimate glimpse into the lives of the artists that we love so much. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and in this episode, number 4, we will be sitting down with Eric Hawk, the guitarist of the band Portugal the Man, whose single Feel It Still, off of their album Woodstock, out now on Atlantic Records, has shot up the Billboard alternative charts to number one and is in the top 10 of the Billboard Hot 100. No small feat right there. Eric is going to talk with us this month about how he made the decision to move to Seattle from the small city of Wasilla, Alaska, and became an integral part of the Northwest music community. And we're also going to talk about this near-fatal incident that took place in 2007, which left Eric as a paraplegic, and how he stayed positive through the experience to get himself back onto the stage to perform. This chat is wonderful, and it was an absolute honor to have Eric in here. And just, I think, you know, you'll feel this too while we're talking about stuff. His goal-oriented nature, his positivity, and his ability to take risks in his line of, or his career of music is nothing short of inspirational. So I think you're really, really going to enjoy this. We do have to say, before we get started here, we want to make sure that you guys go and get tickets to this New Year's Eve show that Artist Home and Seattle Theater Group are putting on with the likes of Hobosexual, Cataldo, The Maldives, Sassy Black, Sundries, Cumulus, and many, many more. Yeah, it's going to be a real, real fun time. So go to stg.org and get yourself some tickets for that. They're now currently $45. All right, we're going to get right into this conversation with Eric Hawk of Portugal the Man. And we're going to start talking about this peculiar visit from Lars Ulrich during during one of Eric's recent shows.
You hear that?
Enjoy.
Clear.
Sounds good, right?
Yeah.
These are the same microphones that, like, you know, Michael Jackson used to use.
Oh, yeah.
What's his butt from Metallica?
Lars. No, just kidding.
No.
James.
Yes.
James
Hetfield. There you go.
Oh, man.
Yeah, these are good. These are great.
Lars Ulrich came to our show, the last show we played in San Francisco.
Really?
At the Independent, which is maybe a 400-person room.
Wow.
Completely sold out. It was a oversell show. You know, mm-hmm. We had the line around the block, and we're just, sorry. Because
we
wanted a small, sweaty, packed room.
Yeah.
But Lars showed up with, like, I don't know, five guys, his handling posse, his entourage. Uh-huh. And they parted the center of the room so Lars could come in and watch for 3 minutes and then leave. That's my story.
You thought
this story.
I thought it was going
to
go.
Dude,
great guy. Like
the best. He brought us out to this strip club in Oakland, and apparently, you know, $10,000 bills are still getting printed. He just
He just parts the sea of people.
I saw him, and then I did not see him, and that's the Lars Ulrich story.
Okay. Yep. Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Well, that's terrible.
Yeah. It only gets better from here.
Well, let's talk about your musical career, because I've been a fan of the bands that you've been in and the people that you play with. We were just talking outside about who you're playing with next, and Matt Beatty, one of my favorite Seattle musicians, who's coming out.
I hate that motherfucker.
Coming out with a new album as Ruler, and I'm very, very excited for it. You're playing with him. You've played with Shelby Earle. You used to play in a band called The Lashes here in Seattle, and now with Portugal the Man. You've been all over the place, man. Like,
yeah,
how did this all start for you?
I get around. You know, it's a. I don't actually hate Matt Beatty. I really love Matt Beatty. Let's get that clear right now.
No,
I love that
record. It came across.
I have a pretty short attention span, and I have a very eclectic set of tastes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for me, I would kind of pick up with any band that I found interesting if they would have me.
Everywhere you look, there's people, but there's no one there to help you. Shouldn't have sold your soul. Shouldn't have given up. Shouldn't have sold your soul. Shouldn't have given up.
Called the Von Bondies. back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, huge hitmakers, Detroit-based, great blues-based rock band.
I don't know if I could place any of their songs. Like, what? Can you sing? Can you sing one?
Not like you can. But there was a huge hit called "Come On, Come On" that was just all over the radio in 2002.
Okay.
You know, the band dissolved. They went their separate ways, and then the singer of that band started up this sort of like Roy Orbison-esque two-step band, like two-step blues band called the Hounds Below. They were touring with This Queen. Rachel's your neighbor, by the way. She lives really close to here.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
She's been on the show when we used to live in Greenwood.
But yeah, super close. And so yeah, they were on tour together, and I went and saw them in Vegas. Because at that point, Christina Bautista was playing bass in This Queen. And
yeah.
I just missed those guys, and it seemed like a great opportunity to go to Vegas for basically no reason.
Yeah.
Have fun and watch one of my favorite bands. But then I saw Jason Solsteimer and the Hounds Below play, and I just really liked the aesthetic. I liked everything that was going on with it. He had sort of changed his voice up to this, like, you know, surly punk rock Roy Orbison kind of thing, and I was just all about it. Like, for whatever reason, it was the right year. It's like 2009. It just fit my mood.
Yeah.
It seemed like a band I could chain smoke in and sip whiskey in.
Right.
And it was rad. So after the show, I went up to him. I'm like, man, I just love what you guys are doing. I would love to record with you. Love to collaborate. He's like, great. What do you play? I'm like, everything. He's like, cool. Do you play organ? Yeah, of course. Of course I play organ.
Did you play organ?
Never played organ in my life.
Oh my God.
So basically, this is 2009.
Okay.
I want to say. So basically I agree to start a tour in a week and a half with this band.
What?
So I get in my car and I put their CD in the CD player, and my car has a little aux jack. I grab my Casio keyboard with an organ sound, and I put cruise control on, and I just listen to this record driving across Montana 90 miles an hour, learning how to play organ to these songs with my right hand.
Well, baby, come on over and say to my face, you don't love me no more, and you're such a waste. Baby, come on over, get to my side.
Front door. Because I would, like, at that point, I would do anything to stay on tour, be on tour.
Okay.
And I did love the band, but, you know, I wrote checks that I clearly couldn't cash. I showed up to their front door, went straight into a rehearsal after driving for 36 hours, and nailed it.
What?
Yeah, killed it. And I had never played those on a full-size keyboard either, which is completely different. You know, it's like a completely different scale. So they've got this beautiful...
But you knew where the notes were, right?
I've got this beautiful Nord, you know, like, organ with piano settings, and I'm surrounded by amplifiers, and I just take a deep breath and sort of fake crack my knuckles, settle down into it, and I'm like, G minor. And yeah, nobody questioned me.
Wait a minute. Oh my God. So, I mean, were you even afraid? Like, was your heart beating fast at this moment? Were you nervous?
The cool guy answer would be no. But yeah, of course. I'm like,
oh my God.
I knew I could do it. I know music. I can fake around it.
Had you learned piano before?
When I was a kid.
Yeah, okay. Totally. Okay. So you knew how to, like, cause I'm picturing the way you're telling this story, I'm picturing in my mind is like, you knew nothing of like playing a piano or anything like that.
I had never played piano or organ in a rock band before.
Okay.
Like nothing, like there's loud drums behind you, there's a guy with a guitar jumping around, stomping and singing into a microphone.
That is amazing.
You know,
Eric.
That's a lot of space between learning Moonlight Sonata when you're seven with like a 70-year-old lady watching over your knuckles to that.
Right.
And that's my scope of experience with keyboards.
Oh my God. So, obviously, you didn't get in a car accident, so that's good.
No.
Yeah.
Got a couple of speeding tickets, but they never looked over and shone a flashlight onto my Casio, and they're like, what are you doing?
What are you doing in here,
sir? What's going on in here?
So that was kind of your first big tour, then?
As a person, No, because Lashes were touring all through 2002 through 2006, basically. Before that, I had toured a bit with this band called Priss. Do you remember those guys?
No.
Really good short-lived power pop band. But that was kind of my first big tour. That was Vendetta Red took us out on that one.
Okay. So you were playing big venues. You had played big venues before.
Yeah, I was like 20 or 21 around then. Kind of getting the lay of the land and figuring out that that's something that you can do. That's a job that you could take.
Right.
Before then, I had no idea.
That's
something that you can just decide to do.
Well, that's the thing that amazes me too, is like there's so many great musicians in the Northwest that, you know, I mean, that's where I come from in music. It's like, that's always like the dream, right? Is like making it work.
Sure.
For you doing it as a job or you know, playing the big venues and being able to pay like your rent or your mortgage or, you know, allowing you to buy a car or something like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not a thing that existed growing up in Wasilla, Alaska. There's not career musicians there. There's Jewel and then nothing, like the guys that, you know,
Jewel was
doing for a hobby. Jewel lived in Homer. I think technically she's from like Colorado. She doesn't really count. But that's the only other Alaskan binary that I had. There's no success stories. There's no model. And the speed that information and media goes up there, at least the speed that it did in the 80s and 90s, like we would get everything 10, 15 years after it happened.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The syndicated TV up there is hilarious. I was watching Three's Company, MASH, Taxi, you know, like all these things that just had no cultural relevance at all. So to understand that you can tour clubs for money with a guitar just didn't exist. And it wasn't until I got down here and started meeting people that do it. You know, at that point, my goal immediately became like, all right, I want a gig bag and a decent guitar and like a 80s Volvo station wagon. And I want to be able to eat 5 days a week. Had an older sister in Wasilla, and my sister had the good sense to get out right after she graduated. Mm-hmm. You know, went off to Harvard and like became her own success story. But her friends that were the same age group were still hanging around the town.
Yeah.
So I had sort of this like precautionary tale, like
you could see
VH1 Behind the Music kind of thing of what my future
where
could be.
Things were going.
Like, you're gonna get that girl pregnant, and you're gonna live in that house, and you're gonna fix up that Ford, and that's gonna be you.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's not. I mean, there's not necessarily anything wrong with that.
So there was fear. It was just fear of getting stuck.
Yeah, I just had to do something. Mm-hmm. Could have done the smart thing and gone to college, but I'm dumb. So
you do not sound like a dumb person to me.
I mean honestly, I did have a guidance counselor that sort of steered me. He's like, you can do the college thing later, but if you're gonna go try and play music, don't do that when you're old.
Yeah Which, right. Good job
John Hill. Wow. Turns out I'm old and I'm still doing it, but man.
Yeah, but you're making it work, man.
Partial credit to him.
You're making it work.
Yeah.
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 So when do the Lashes start?
I got pretty lucky. So I moved November of 99, got a job at the Levi store in December of 99, and I met one Benjamin Clark from the Lashes in February of 2000. Yeah. had a band together. I was his boss at the time. I just kind of hired him, and just his confidence alone swayed me into picking up with him. What it really was is his second guitarist ended up going to Japan on a whim, just decided to take a vacation, got the opportunity to go. So Ben cornered me. I would bring an acoustic guitar into the office every now and then,
yeah,
and go play in the stock room. So he knew I could kind of play, but he comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, can you learn 11 songs in 2 days?" And
so he just kind of heard you playing in the stock room or the break room or something like that, and he was like,
"Who knows what I'm playing? Work. I'm playing like CCR or something. Who knows?" And he's like, "That's good enough for me. Can you learn this many songs in this many days?" And of course I said, yeah, totally. And that was it. That guitarist never came back. And that band was essentially together for a decade.
Yeah.
And took me all kinds of crazy places. We signed with Lookout Records shortly after that. Then we upstreamed to Columbia Records after that, put out a full length, got to see the country and
Tell me a little bit about that experience, because you're still, relatively young at that point.
Oh, I didn't know shit. Yeah.
And you guys get signed to Columbia Records, and you must have been just over the moon.
Oh yeah. I copied that contract and sent it to every teacher or babysitter or aunt or, you know, concerned grandparent that I could. That was huge. It's crazy thinking about it in hindsight, but I definitely, like, I knew that was something that I wanted, but I didn't know what it meant. If that makes sense, you know?
Okay.
Like, I don't know if this is a contract that's just guaranteed fame. At that point, I feel like major labels were still kind of handing out contracts like that without any real expectation. There's some crazy, you know, figure where 1 out of 20 records were recouping back then.
Yeah.
So they have a 5% success
rate. Well, because that's right around where Napster was really coming into, or had that already folded and gone through the ringer.
That was
like 2000, 2001, yeah, maybe?
That was happening, but like the label still wanted to win.
Uh-huh.
You know, but that like 1 out of 20 records is making its money back. That is a 5% success rate as a business model. I can't think of any other business in the world. Like if 1 out of 20 croissants is delicious, this bakery is going to be just fine.
Right.
It's crazy. It's hectic.
Was there an expectation on your part that like once you got this, like, cause the Lashes, I mean, they were big here in Seattle as far as I know, or from what I can remember, you guys were fairly popular. You had a name.
We were polarizing figures is how I would say it.
Really?
I mean, we talked a big game. And at that point in Seattle, that's, you know, you've got these sort of humbled, shrug-shouldered frontmen like Isaac Brock and, you know, all these anti-hero heroes and, you know, Ben Gibbard and guys like that. Talking loudly about yourself and being braggadocious was just not the game plan to find indie rock success in Seattle.
Yeah.
Signing to a major label when you're kind of undercooked and underdeveloped was not the game plan for success.
I always remember there were a couple of your songs, and I'm failing to remember the names of them, but like
they're all good.
They were great. They were great pop songs, man. They were, you know, along the lines of the Strokes, you know, that type of music, and we had
a hell of a hit with Sometimes the Sun.
Yes,
that song's really special to me, and still gets me on some kind of level. Like I'm proud of that. I'll stand behind that song. But we jumped into it after that lineup of the band had probably only played maybe 100-150 shows at that point.
Yeah,
and they're just off you go. Here you go. Like,
yeah. So was there an expectation like, okay, now we've signed to this huge label, like now we're huge. Like, did you think that once you went out on tour after signing, that was like, oh, we're going to, you know, no more playing in like, you know, 4-person rooms, you know?
I mean, we spent the next 6 or 7 years playing in 150 person rooms.
Uh-huh.
We still worked and we did all the radio hustling and, you know, we tried to sell it. And if we weren't the greatest musicians in the world, we were pretty good salesmen, mm-hmm. pretty good pitchmen.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there was that great expectation of just like, no one got comfortable. No one, you know, rested on it. They didn't give us $1 million. They gave us like $7,000.
Right. Yeah.
When which finally allowed me to buy that vintage Volvo.
That vintage Volvo.
Like I finally got it. So for me, yeah, that was a check, check, check. That yeah. Hitting all the boxes.
I just bought a $400 car.
I got a car and I got a clamshell cell phone. Yeah. I got this dope ass digital camera built into my phone. Yeah. You know, I went home for the, I think we got our advance in like November, and then I went home for the holidays that December, mm-hmm. just carrying my head so high.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Debt free.
Debt free. I love it. Oh man, that's so great. Sometimes the sun goes down, sometimes it comes back up. So 2007 rolls around, and you're playing with the Lashes, right?
Oh, yeah.
And things are going moderately well. You guys are still touring. And
at that point, it's kind of an interesting time in our history. We had put out a record. We had a single that was doing some things, but that was mostly 2005-ish, 2006. Okay. That was kind of our heyday. By the time 2007 rolled around, we weren't really sure if we were dropped, what was going on. Phone calls were not getting answered as quickly as they had before. And it was just sort of a weird time. We're still playing shows, but yeah, the future was a little bit up in the air.
Yeah. So walk me through this a little bit. Like, something happens in 2007 that basically changes your life.
Yeah.
Not basically, it does. It changes your life.
It substantially alters the flow. I'll say that. Yeah, I fell into a 12-foot hole and severed my spine and became a paraplegic.
Yeah.
Which they haven't really figured out a quick cure for that. So I sit in front of you today still, you know, slightly older and slightly more handsome paraplegic, but still, you know.
Most handsome paraplegic ever.
I'll take it, man. There's not that many of us running around, but sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, definitely not running around.
Oh. God, I gotta go.
So what I've read is that you were at a party, mm-hmm. and you leaned up against a wall, mm-hmm. and fell into a massive hole.
Giant hole, yeah. Holding it together, but it's hard to see clouds when you're 6 feet underground. Keep building a house, then tearing it down, and it goes on, on, it goes on. Yeah, turns out you read the right article.
Yeah.
It's crazy how much that story kind of got ran with, and I've read 10 different versions of
really?
My own experience. But yeah, I mean, that was it. I was at a dinner party and sat on a retaining wall that crumbled away and fell into a hole.
That's yeah.
Game over.
Did you know it was happening at the time? I mean, that seems like something that would like happen in a split second.
Yeah, it did, but I was conscious through the whole time. Through the whole experience, conscious when they loaded me up into the ambulance, and I knew what was going on. I'm not a doctor, but I understand, you know, EMTs being very concerned about, you know, things like permanent tissue damage and things like that. You know, your ears perk up when you hear things like that when they're talking about you.
Yeah. and not being able to feel your toes or something like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty good indicator.
Yeah. So what's going through your mind at that point? Like,
at that point, I mean, honestly, I just it was like embarrassment and shock and fear and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, I was fortunate enough that the accident happened pretty much 4 blocks away from Harborview.
Mm-hmm.
They loaded me straight up there. I went into surgery the next day, and within 3 or 4 days, I started getting flooded with friends and community and family and people coming out. And I didn't want, it's that pride again, you know, it's that hubris. Like, I just wanted to prove that I was strong enough to get through whatever was thrown at me, whether it was homelessness or getting dropped from a label or any of that kind of stuff. I'm like, oh, I got this. This is fine. I'm going to be the most charismatic, upfront, like gregarious paraplegic of all time. So, you know, I just had a whole community of people that weren't going to let me dwell on it or get sad. It's like, this is your reality now. Here's your timeline. Get back to it.
Man, I would have a hard time being in that position.
I'm not saying it wasn't a hard time.
You know, Well, But like staying or achieving positivity in a situation like that for a personality like mine would be next to impossible.
I mean, sure. Sure. You know, I think it was hard for me too. I think it'd be hard for anyone. It's not the coolest hand to be dealt with, but when you're kind of thrust into that thing, into that position, you start looking for the other scenarios. Like, you start kind of trying to count your blessings and figure out where you're at. And when it happened to me, it was the beginning of the summer. I went straight into a trauma center, which was just covered, surrounded in worst case scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got like 17-year-old kids that are diving headfirst into a riverbed and like, you know, just people. You know, all I knew is that I had my hands, I had my wrists, I had my shoulders. I was strong. I didn't have any brain trauma. I'm still as stubborn then as I was then. And you get to a point where priorities and I gotta backtrack here a little bit, man.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. No problem.
I think when you're rolling into that and you're kind of looking around and you're going through physical therapy or, you know, occupational therapy, you know, I'm sitting next to people that are learning how to eat again and people that have assisted breathing devices and things like that. And, you know, at that point you're like big man on campus. And you almost sort of become a mascot for that rehabilitation center where it's like, I can go so fast in my wheelchair and I'm the strongest man in the world. And I would do my best to try and help out people that were having a harder time of it. And I would stay extra long at the therapy sessions and, you know, just see what other people were going through. And I'd try and stay positive for the whole unit. It's almost kind of like, you know, this military mentality where, you know, your mental strength is going to carry you through this thing.
Yeah.
Even if your physical self is going through whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And being part of a community, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's beautiful. In the context of like your music, like, was it, did that hit hard too? Like, did you think that like, oh, this part of my life is now done?
I requested just a handful of items once I got moved to my own room. mm-hmm. out of the trauma center. I wanted a Dick's Deluxe. I wanted a fan because it was summer and that place isn't air
hotter
conditioned.
Than shit.
And I wanted an acoustic guitar and some way to record it. And that was it. That was it for me. While I was in my hospital bed, I recorded some tracks for, do you know Shane Tutmark? You know that guy?
Yeah, I do.
So he had that project called The Traveling Mercies mm-hmm. around that time. Came into my room, couple of field recorders, couple of acoustics, and we tracked a song before I could sit up, basically, like while I was still in a gravity bed. I just wanted to get back at it.
Yeah.
Wanted to bite into it.
And make sure that you didn't lose it.
Oh, I had it. I had my hands and I had my stubbornness and
So there was no fear to that would go away.
No, hell no, man. I'm not going to learn a new vocation. I'm not going to study, you know, God bless all the blue collar workers in this world and everyone that does plumbing and all the electrical technicians and everyone else, but like I just knew that I knew how to do one thing already.
Yeah.
Let's keep doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. So the narrative goes that you had, what was it? A show at Bumbershoot or something like that.
That's right.
That, with the Lashes.
Yep.
And you were determined to make it back up on stage and play that show.
Yeah. Again, like our star hadn't faded, but it was certainly dimming at that mm-hmm. point. So that was the only show that we had on the calendar for months.
Yeah.
In months. And, I did that kind of thing, that Cape Fear moment where you cross out the red X's on the calendar, counting down the days until that show. And there was no way I wasn't going to play that show. And I did.
And how did that feel? Was it any different than anything else? Was it significant in any way for you?
That was the biggest crowd that we had played in years, honestly. And I after it was all done, kind of cleared out my head. My mom went back to her hotel room. My friends parted. The band all hugged me. And I was just kind of left there by myself, wandering around the festival. I'm like, well, if I can do this, I can do whatever.
Yeah.
Like, if I can cut it on that stage, I can keep this up.
When talking on the phone didn't do much for me, I didn't know what to do. So I came on down.
I traveled the world for a moment. I get to experience cultures, different cultures on a daily basis. Like I get to skip country lines and my passport gets stamped constantly. I'm on my second and it's getting pulled up. And, I get to sort of experience a lot of places and a lot of people. And I'll go to certain places. God, I don't know if I want to go down this narrative. We'll just say it. Like, so I spent a few weeks in Japan a number of years ago. Uh-huh. And Japan is lovely and it goes out of its way to sort of be in the forefront of accessibility in terms of adaptive technology in the future. They have these escalators everywhere where two people will turn a key on either side of the escalator and this flat platform appears, like four of the steps in the escalator go flat.
Wow.
And then you load yourself up and they turn the key again and up you go. Uh-huh. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. No matter how many times I've seen it, it still blows my mind. But at the same time, I was the only sort of young, able-bodied guy zipping around in a chair. I saw, you know, some elderly people in wheelchairs. I saw, you know, people in motorized things. But I am pretty sure I was the only young guy that I saw in pretty much a month in Japan just zipping around. Mm-hmm. And I kind of became a spectacle. Also, I'm white and blonde-haired and blue-eyed.
Right.
That's a whole thing
into
itself. But, I don't think they had ever seen anyone pushing their own chair down streets, dodging potholes, jumping up curbs.
Mm-hmm.
because I just don't think that's expected. I think in a lot of places, if you're injured or you sustain an injury, you know, you become sort of the responsibility of the family that you're in, and you sort of get tucked away, hidden away, something like that.
So did that bother you a little bit? Like that you were like that people were, you know, staring at you or,
I love that. Do you? I love that shit. I don't care. I'm about that. I totally don't care. It bothers me that, you know, I didn't have any peers. I didn't have anyone else to zip around with.
Gotcha. Or, yeah.
You know, like that it was shocking. Like it bothers, like any of that kind of stuff. Like if I'm the first person that you've seen play guitar in a wheelchair, that doesn't make me special. That just means like,
I haven't seen enough.
I know for a fact that there's other guys out there. Yeah. Like I know some personally that can outplay me, that shred better than I do. They're just not out there. They're not visible.
Right. Right.
So that's my job. My job is to just stay as visible as I can and change whatever I can.
That's awesome. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a little baby girl is in need. Am I coming out of left field? I'm a rebel just for kicks. I've been feeling it since 1966. I'll be over now, but I feel it still.
How does Portugal the Man come into the fold?
Well, basically with these guys, I grew up with them. I went to elementary school with the singer. I was in jazz band through middle school and high school with the bass player. Kyle, the keyboard player, I played with him in KK and his Weathered Underground back in the day. Great Seattle band. You know, I've known Jason for years. I've known all these guys for a decade plus. And specifically the Alaska Boys, I've known them for 20 years. We've been trying to make something like this work for years and years and years and years. They asked me to go out on the Church Mouth tour in 2007. Timing wasn't right. Couldn't do it. Had my hands full. And, you know, that time period kind of passed. They've brought me up for festivals and, yeah, basically starting in 2009, if we were in the same place, in the same city at the same time.
You'd go play.
I'd go play. I'd go jump up on stage, grab my guitar. They're like, there's this song's in B minor. Just jam in B minor for 64 measures, which is great. And that's kind of the vibe of this band. Is there's opportunities to just dick around on guitar for a long time.
Sure. That's great.
Which is fantastic. Eventually, you know, they started talking about the logistics of touring and what, you know, what it would actually be as me being a full-time member of the band. And that involved me learning all the details of all these songs, like learning the structures, learning the key changes, like actually being able to sing the backups and know the details for basically 120 songs. This band's been at it forever. And, you know, I didn't know if it was going to be one tour, 10 tours a year, however much. I was just kind of focused on like the one tour that they asked me to be on. I felt like I had a little something to prove.
And this was in what, 2015?
2015, like yeah. And again, like it meant I had to basically quit all my other bands, which was a little bittersweet, very bittersweet.
Yeah.
But the thing about me having my hands in a lot of different projects was I like a lot of stylistic variety in what I play. I get bored doing the same thing. Like, get bored just playing pop punk or funk or whatever. But with this band, it's stylistically diverse within its own camp. Like they've put out 8 records and they're all wildly different.
Yeah.
Like for people that have never heard the band before, you know, the first record is sort of a prog punk, you know, different time signature kind of thing. Second record is straight up blues rock. Third record is kind of, you know, more of a pop nouveau kind of thing. And it travels a lot of different places. So within a set in this band, we get to traverse a lot of genres.
Yeah.
And have a lot of fun.
Might be over now, but I feel
Still, which is out everywhere right now. It's on every radio. My daughters are singing it.
Aww.
You know, and they, it's so funny. We got to say this too. Like when you came over, they were like, is he here yet? Is he here yet? Can we go say hi?
Oh my God.
And they're getting ready for bed. And I was like, okay, yeah, he's in the studio. So they ran back here, and that's when they ran back, and you were playing my daughter's guitar, and, oh, and she probably is going to covet that now.
They are the sweetest, you know? Girls. They're so good.
But, I mean, it's everywhere. It's a, you can't get away from it. It's a great song. It's a fantastic song.
Thank you.
Was there any... Was there a moment where you guys like step back and go, "Ooh, this is new territory"?
There have been like 40 moments where we've done that, and we keep kind of. I mean, it's so far flung, so widespread at this point. We just moved on to the pop charts, which means we're working with a whole different team at the label.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the difference between, you know, Guy Ritchie making Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels for $2 or $3 million with his friends. Him making King Arthur for $150 million. Like, it's, there's all these cliches that go around with
King Arthur. That's terrible.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't, but it looks awful.
It's awesome. Watch it. CGI dragons, man.
Okay.
But it's still...
Wait, there are dragons in it?
But it's still Guy Ritchie. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, it's... Give it a chance.
Okay.
You're going to like it. There's all these cliches that go along with that where it's like, oh, riding a rocket ship or, you know, when you're on the pop charts. I think as of right now, we just broke into the top 20 on the Billboard Hot 100.
Right.
And they say things like, you know, the chart position ahead of you is selling twice as much as you are, and the position behind you is selling half as much as you are. Like, the numbers get exponential.
So
they get crazy.
Yeah. So when you hear that, though, like, what goes through your mind? Like, do you not care, or are you just are you indifferent? Like, is it just like,
I don't give a fuck about the numbers, about the like nitty gritty nuts and bolts. I do know that suddenly I have like 7 new aunts that have heard it because it was on Kathy Lee and Hoda.
Oh, dear God.
Like, it's, you know, it was on the PGA golf tournament opening. It's getting into places. We're not asking for this. Both of those were completely unsolicited.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a PR machine. That's not publicity. That's not the label. That's not management.
That's just somebody picking it up and putting it on.
These are just guys being like, cool song.
Yeah.
Cool deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, back to the cliches, back to the hackneyed cliches. It's like the difference between minor leagues and major leagues. Because even when it was number one at AAA or number one at alternative, it didn't really change our lives or the venues that we're playing or the demographics that we're playing to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But suddenly, like, we're on these pop charts and I'm seeing us on playlists with, you know, Despacito and then us and then Jay-Z and then Chance the Rapper. And that's psychotic. Like, that boggles my brain.
So the tour is coming up. Yeah. As of right now, when we're talking, the tour is encroaching in it's time.
Like a week.
Yeah. And is that nerve-wracking at all?
Mm. I don't know how to be home.
Yeah.
I kind of need to be on tour.
Things. Even I'm not even talking about like being on the road. I'm talking about like being on stage in front of like a massive number of people.
The harder shows are when it's like we're doing the radio station thing the morning of that show.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we do the overnight drive in the bus.
Sure.
It's like a 6-hour drive.
Wake up early.
Columbus to Evanston or Columbus to like Chicago. And you wake up and your manager pokes you in the chest with two fingers and he's like, get to the radio station, get to the radio station. And you wake up at 9 and you go play this thing on acoustic guitars for like contest winners.
Mm-hmm.
Those are always 1,000 times more awkward than the big show with your lights and the fog machine and the projection behind you.
Yeah. 'Cause
you look cool at that moment. You don't look cool hungover at a regional radio station in the morning playing your songs acoustic, having fever sweats and like trying to make sure that your falsetto doesn't crack.
Right.
I love those shows too for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
Like, and I think we're really good at those shows. I think this band, this group of guys, like, we don't play to tracks. We don't play to click tracks. We don't do the Ableton thing. There's no laptops.
Yeah.
Like, we are always kind of disconjointed in terms of, you know, our professionalism.
Yeah. Well, I see, like, you know, I watched a performance today of one of those performances with the acoustic guitars on a morning radio show or something like that. And the horn section is played on a keyboard.
On a 25-key keyboard.
Yeah,
the only thing that he can fit in a carry-on bag. Like, it's seriously.
But that's the first thing I thought about when you were telling the story about driving 90 miles an hour, playing it on your Casio.
Yeah, full circle, baby.
Full circle, full circle. Well, Eric, I am ecstatic about your success, and I'm super happy to see that you're doing so well. And the new music is fantastic. The album is called Woodstock, and it's out now. Thank you so much for coming in, man. This has been a real treat. Thanks.
Thanks for letting me hang out, man.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Thanks. Well, there you have it, everybody. Eric Hawk, the band Portugal the Man. Big thanks to Eric for taking the time to chat with me this episode. I had a wonderful, wonderful time talking with him and getting the rundown, man, of how his life has unfolded. Very, very interesting guy, and I wish him all the best in the future. If you'd like to see Eric on tour with Portugal the Man, you can go to portugaltheman.com and check out all of the dates that are going on here in October 2017 throughout the United States. They just got back off the European leg of the tour and now are embarking on the U.S. portion. And they've got a ton of stuff. So go to portugaltheman.com. Get your hand on the record, Woodstock. And go check them out live as well. So big thanks to Eric. Big thanks also are due for Kevin Sir, Chad Claiborne, and Phil O'Sullivan of Artist Home for making this podcast possible. And if you guys like what you hear, please spread it around. That's the biggest way you can help out us. All right? And you can find us at the beginning of every month, the first of every month, right there at artisthome.org or wherever else podcasts are available. Okay, thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to go out today with the song by The Lashes. This one's called Sometimes the Sun. You heard little clips of it earlier in the episode. It's off the album Get It from 2006. And yeah, have a great month, everybody. We'll see you next time.